Disc 2.
If Hoover didn't take the hint, and if he didn't reveal something about his financial situation, then they'd drop him. Within the Bureau of Prisons, Trumbull was officially referred to as a camp. Such a designation meant there were no fences around the grounds, no razor wire, no watchtowers, no guards with rifles waiting to nail escapees. A camp meant minimum security so that any inmate could simply walk away if he chose. There were 1,000 at Trumbull, but few walked away. It was nicer than most public schools. Air-conditioned dorms, clean cafeteria serving 3 squares a day, a weight room, billiards, cards, racquetball, basketball, volleyball, jogging track, library, chapel, ministers on duty, counselors, caseworkers, unlimited visiting hours. Trumbull was as good as it could get for prisoners, all of whom were classified as low risk. 80% were there for drug crimes. About 40 had robbed banks without hurting or really scaring anyone. The rest were white-collar types whose crimes ranged from small-time scams to Dr. Floyd, a surgeon whose office had bilked Medicare out of $6 million over 2 decades. Violence was not tolerated at Trumbull. Threats were rare. There were plenty of rules, and the administration had little trouble enforcing them. If you screwed up, they sent you away to a medium-security prison, one with razor wire and rough guards. Trumbull's prisoners were content to behave themselves and count their days the federal way. Pursuing serious criminal activity on the inside was unheard of until the arrival of Joe Roy Spicer. Before his fall, Spicer had heard stories about the Angola scam, named for the infamous Louisiana State Penitentiary. Some inmates there had perfected the gay extortion scheme, and before they were caught, they had fleeced their victims out of $700,000. Spicer was from a rural county near the Louisiana line, and the Angola scam was a notorious affair in his part of the state. He never dreamed he'd copy it, but he woke up one morning in a federal pen and decided to shaft every living soul he could get close enough to. He walked the track every day at 1 p.m., usually alone, always with a pack of Marlboros. He hadn't smoked for 10 years before his incarceration. Now he was up to 2 packs a day. So he walked to negate the damage to his lungs. In 34 months, he'd walked 1,242 miles. And he'd lost 20 pounds, though probably not from exercise, as he liked to claim. The prohibition against beer was more responsible for the weight loss. 34 months of walking and smoking, 21 months to go. $90,000 of the stolen bingo money was literally buried in his backyard, a half a mile behind his house next to a tool shed. Entombed in a homemade concrete vault his wife knew nothing about. She'd helped him spend the rest of the loot, $180,000 altogether, though the feds had traced only half of it. They'd bought Cadillacs and flown to Las Vegas first class out of New Orleans, and they'd been driven around by casino limos and put up in suites. If he had any dreams left, one was to be a professional gambler headquartered out of Vegas, but known and feared by casinos everywhere. Blackjack was his game, and though he'd lost a ton, he was still convinced he could beat any house. There were casinos in the Caribbean he'd never seen. Asia was heating up. He'd travel the world first class, with or without his wife, stay in fancy suites, order room service, and terrorize any blackjack dealer dumb enough to deal him cards. He'd take the $90,000 from his backyard, add it to his share of the Angola scam, and move to Vegas, with or without her. She hadn't been to Trumbull in 4 months, although she used to come every 3 weeks. He had nightmares of her plowing up the backyard looking for his buried treasure. He was almost convinced she didn't know about the money, but there was room for doubt. He'd been drinking 2 nights before being shipped off to prison and had said something about the $90,000. He couldn't remember his exact words. Try as he might, he simply could not recall what he'd told her. He lit another Marlboro at mile 1. Maybe she had a boyfriend now. Rita Spicer was an attractive woman, a little chunky in places, but nothing $90,000 couldn't hide. What if she and a new squeeze had found the money and were already spending it? One of Joe Roy's worst recurring nightmares was a scene from a bad movie, Rita and some unknown male with shovels digging like idiots in the rain. Why the rain, he didn't know, but it was always at night, in the middle of a thunderstorm, and the lightning would flash, and he would see them slogging their way through the backyard, each time getting nearer and nearer to the tool shed. In one dream, the new mystery boyfriend was on a bulldozer, pushing piles of dirt all over the Spicer farm, while Rita stood nearby, pointing here and there with her shovel. Joe Roy craved the money. He could feel the cash in his hands. He would steal and extort all he could while he counted his days at Trumbull, then he would rescue his buried loot and head for Vegas. No one in his hometown would have the pleasure of pointing and whispering and saying, "There's old Joe Roy, guess he's out of the pen now." No, sir. He'd be living the high life, with or without her. Chapter 4 Teddy looked at his pill bottles lined along the edge of his table like little executioners ready to take away his misery. York was seated across from him, reading from his notes. York said, "He was on the phone until 3 this morning talking to friends in Arizona."
"Who?"
"Bobby Lander, Jim Gallison, Richard Hassel, the usual gang, his money people."
"Dale Weiner?"
"Yes, him too," York said, amazed at Teddy's recall. Teddy had his eyes closed now and was rubbing his temples. Somewhere between them, somewhere deep in his brain, he knew the names of Lake's friends, his contributors, his confidants, his poll workers, and his old high school teachers. All of it neatly tucked away, ready to be used if necessary.
"Anything unusual?"
"No, not really. Just the typical questions you'd expect from a man contemplating such an unexpected move. His friends were surprised, even shocked, and somewhat reluctant, but they'll come around."
"Did they ask about money?"
"Of course. He was vague, said it would not be a problem, though. They are skeptical."
"Did he keep our secrets?"
"He certainly did."
"Was he worried about us listening?"
"I don't think so. He made 11 calls from his office and 8 from his home, none from his cell phones."
"Faxes, email?"
"None. He spent 2 hours with Chiara, his chief of staff." "Right. They basically planned the campaign. Chiara wants to run it. They like Nance of Michigan as VP.
"Not a bad choice."
"He looks fine. We're already checking him. Had a divorce when he was 23, but that was 30 years ago."
"Not a problem. Is Lake ready to commit?"
"Oh, yes. He's a politician, isn't he? He's been promised the keys to the kingdom. He's already writing speeches." Teddy removed a pill from a bottle and swallowed it without the aid of anything liquid. He frowned as if it was bitter. He squeezed the wrinkles in his forehead and said,
"York, tell me we're not missing anything on this guy. No skeletons."
"No skeletons, Chief. We've examined his dirty underwear for 6 months. There's nothing that can hurt us."
"He's not going to marry some fool, is he?"
"No. He dates several women, but nothing serious."
"No sex with his interns?"
"None. He's clean." They were repeating a dialogue they'd had many times. Once more wouldn't hurt.
"No shady financial deals from another lifetime?"
"This is his life, Chief. There's nothing back there."
"Booze, drugs, prescription pills, gambling on the internet?"
"No, sir. He's very clean, sober, straight, bright. Pretty remarkable."
"Let's talk to him."
Aaron Lake was once again escorted to the same room deep inside Langley, this time with 3 handsome young men guarding him as if danger lurked at every corner. He walked even quicker than the day before, his head even taller, his back without the slightest curve. His stature was rising by the hour. Once again he said hello to Teddy and shook his calloused hand, then followed the quilt-laden wheelchair into the bunker and sat across the table. Pleasantries were exchanged. York watched from a room down the hall where three monitors hooked to hidden cameras relayed every word, every movement. Next to York were two men who spent their time studying tapes of people as they talked and breathed and moved their hands and eyes and heads and feet, all in an effort to determine what the speakers really meant.
"Did you sleep much last night?" Teddy asked, managing a smile.
"Yes, actually," Lake lied.
"Good. I take it you're willing to accept our deal."
"Deal? I didn't know it was exactly a deal."
"Oh, yes, Mr. Lake. It's exactly a deal. We promise to get you elected, and you promise to double defense spending and get ready for the Russians."
"Then you have a deal."
"That's good, Mr. Lake. I'm very pleased. You'll make an excellent candidate and a fine president."
The words rang through Lake's ears, and he couldn't believe them. President Lake. President Aaron Lake. He'd paced the floors until 5 that morning, trying to convince himself that the White House was being offered to him. It seemed too easy. And as hard as he tried, he couldn't ignore the trappings. The Oval Office, all those jets and helicopters, the world to be traveled, 100 aides at his beck and call, state dinners with the most powerful people in the world. And above all, a place in history.
Oh, yes. Teddy had himself a deal.
"Let's talk about the campaign itself," Teddy said. "I think you should announce 2 days after New Hampshire. Let the dust settle. Let the winners get their 15 minutes and let the losers sling more mud, then announce."
"That's pretty fast," Lake said.
"We don't have a lot of time.
We ignore New Hampshire and get ready for Arizona and Michigan on February the 22nd. It's imperative that you win those 2 states. When you do, you establish yourself as a serious candidate and you're set for the month of March."
"I was thinking of announcing back home somewhere in Phoenix."
"Michigan's better. It's a bigger state, 58 delegates compared to 24 for Arizona. You'll be expected to win at home. If you win in Michigan on the same day, then you're a candidate to be reckoned with. Announce in Michigan first, then do it again hours later in your home district."
"An excellent idea.
There's a helicopter plant in Flint, D.L. Trilling. They have a large hangar, 4,000 workers. The CEO is a man I can talk to."
"Book it," Lake said, certain that Teddy had already chatted with the CEO.
"Can you start filming ads day after tomorrow?"
"I can do anything," Lake said, settling into the passenger seat. It was becoming obvious who was driving the bus.
"With your approval, we'll hire an outside consulting group to front the ads and publicity. But we have better people here, and they won't cost you anything. Not that money will be a problem, you understand."
"I think $100 million should cover things."
"It should. Anyway, we'll start working on the TV ads today. I think you'll like them. They're total gloom and doom, the miserable shape of our military, all sorts of threats from abroad, Armageddon, that sort of stuff. They'll scare the hell out of people. We'll plug in your name and face in a few brief words, and in no time you'll be the most famous politician in the country."
"Fame won't win the election."
"No, it won't. But money will.
Money buys television and polls, and that's all it takes."
"I'd like to think the message is important."
"Oh, it is, Mr. Lake. And our message is far more important than tax cuts and affirmative action and abortion and trust and family values and all the other silliness we're hearing. Our message is life and death. Our message will change the world and protect our affluence. That's all we really care about."
Lake was nodding his agreement. Protect the economy, keep the peace, and American voters would elect anyone.
"I have a good man to run the campaign," Lake said, anxious to offer something.
"Who?"
"Mike Sciarra, my chief of staff." He's my closest advisor, a man I trust implicitly. Any experience on the national level? Teddy asked, knowing full well there was none. No, but he's quite capable. That's fine, it's your campaign. Lake smiled and nodded at the same time. That was good to hear, he was beginning to wonder.
What about Vice President? Teddy asked.
I have a couple of names. Senator Nance of Michigan is an old friend. There's also Governor Geis from Texas. Teddy received the names with careful deliberation. Not bad selections, really, though Geis would never work. He was a rich boy who'd skated through college and golfed through his 30s, then spent a fortune of his father's money to purchase the governor's mansion for 4 years. Besides, they wouldn't have to worry about Texas.
I like Nance, Teddy said.
Then Nance it would be, Lake almost said. They talked about money for an hour, the first wave from the PACs, and how to accept instant millions without creating too much suspicion. Then the second wave from the defense contractors, then the third wave of cash and other untraceables. There'd be a fourth wave Lake would never know about. Depending on the polls, Teddy Maynard and his organization would be prepared to literally haul boxes filled with cash into union halls and black churches and white VFWs in places like Chicago and Detroit and Memphis and throughout the Deep South. Working with locals they were already identifying, they would be prepared to buy every vote they could find. The more Teddy pondered his plan, the more convinced he became that the election would be won by Mr. Aaron Lake. Trevor's little law office was in Neptune Beach, several blocks from Atlantic Beach, though no one could tell where one beach stopped and the other started. Jacksonville was 10 miles to the west and creeping toward the sea every minute. The office was a converted summer rental, and from his sagging back porch, Trevor could see the beach and the ocean and hear the seagulls. Hard to believe he'd been renting the place for 12 years now. Early in the lease, he'd enjoyed hiding on the porch, away from the phone and the clients, staring endlessly at the gentle waters of the Atlantic 2 blocks away. He was from Scranton, and like all snowbirds, he'd finally grown weary of gazing at the sea, roaming the beaches barefoot and throwing breadcrumbs to the birds. Now he preferred to waste time locked in his office. Trevor was terrified of courtrooms and judges. While this was unusual and even somewhat honorable, it made for a different style of lawyering. It relegated Trevor to paperwork, real estate closings, wills, leases, zoning, all the mundane, non-dazzling, small-time areas of the profession no one told him about in law school. Occasionally, he handled a drug case, never one involving a trial, and it was one of his unfortunate clients at Trumbull who'd connected him with the Honorable Joe Roy Spicer. In short order, he'd become the official attorney for all three, Spicer, Beach, and Yarber, the Brethren, as even Trevor referred to them. He was a courier, nothing more or less. He smuggled them letters disguised as official legal documents and thus protected by the lawyer-client privilege. And he sneaked their letters out. He gave them no advice, and they sought none. He ran their bank account offshore and handled phone calls from the families of their clients inside Trumbull. He fronted their dirty little deals, and in doing so avoided courtrooms and judges and other lawyers, and this suited Trevor just fine. He was also a member of their conspiracy, easily indictable should they ever be exposed, but he wasn't worried. The Angola scam was absolutely brilliant because its victims couldn't complain. For an easy fee with potential rewards, he'd gamble with the Brethren. He eased from his office without seeing his secretary, then sneaked away in his restored 1970 VW Beetle, no air conditioning. He drove down First Street toward Atlantic Boulevard, the ocean visible through homes and cottages and rentals. He wore old khakis, a white cotton shirt, a yellow bow tie, a blue seersucker jacket, all of it heavily wrinkled. He passed Pete's Bar and Grill, the oldest watering hole along the beaches, and his personal favorite, even though the college kids had discovered the place. He had an outstanding and very past-due bar tab there of $361, almost all for Coors Longnecks and Lemon Daiquiris, and he really wanted to clear the debt. He turned west on Atlantic Boulevard and began fighting the traffic into Jacksonville. He cursed the sprawl and the congestion and the cars with Canadian plates. Then he was on the bypass, north, past the airport, and soon deep into the flat Florida countryside. 50 minutes later, he parked at Trumbull. "You gotta love the federal system," he told himself again. Lots of parking, close to the front entrance, nicely landscaped grounds tended daily by the inmates, and modern, well-kept buildings. He said, "Hello, Mackie," to the white guard at the door, and "Hello, Vince," to the black one. Rufus, at the front desk, x-rayed the briefcase while Nadine did the paperwork for his visit. "How are the bass?" he asked Rufus. "Ain't biting," Rufus said. No lawyer in the brief history of Trumbull had visited as much as Trevor. They took his picture again, stamped the back of his hand with invisible ink, and led him through two doors and a short hallway. "Hello, Link," he said to the next guard. "Morning, Trevor," Link said. Link ran the visitor's area, a large open space with lots of padded chairs and vending machines against one wall, a playground for youngsters, and a small outdoor patio where two people could sit at a picnic table and share a moment. It was cleaned and shined and completely empty. It was a weekday. Traffic picked up on Saturdays and Sundays, but for the rest of the time, Link observed an empty area. They went to the lawyer's room, one of several private cubbyholes with doors that shut and windows through which Link could do his observing, if he were so inclined. Joe Roy Spicer was waiting and reading the daily sports section, where he played the odds on college basketball. Trevor and Link stepped into the room together, and very quickly Trevor removed two $20 bills and handed them to Link. The closed-circuit cameras couldn't see them if they did this just inside the door. As part of the routine, Spicer pretended not to see the transaction. Then the briefcase was opened, and Link made a pretense of looking through it. He did this without touching a thing. Trevor removed a large manila envelope, which was sealed and marked in bold, "Legal Papers." Link took it and squeezed it to make sure it held only papers and not a gun or a bottle of pills, then he gave it back. They'd done this dozens of times. Trumbull regulations required a guard to be present in the room when all papers were removed and all envelopes were opened. But the 220s got Link outside, where he posted himself at the door because there was simply nothing else to guard at the moment. He knew letters were being passed back and forth, and he didn't care. As long as Trevor didn't traffic in weapons or drugs, Link wouldn't get involved. The place had so many silly regulations anyway. He leaned on the door with his back to it, and before long was drifting into one of his many horse naps, one leg stiff, the other bent at the knee. In the lawyer's room, little legal work was being done. Spicer was still absorbed in point spreads. Most inmates welcomed their guests. Spicer only tolerated his. "Got a call last night from the brother of Jeff Daggett," Trevor said, "the kid from Coral Gables." "I know him," Spicer said, finally lowering his newspaper because money was on the horizon. "He got 12 years in a drug conspiracy." "Yep. His brother says that there's this ex-federal judge inside Trumbull who's looked over his papers and thinks he might be able to knock off a few years. This judge wants a fee, so Daggett calls his brother, who calls me." Trevor removed his rumpled blue seersucker jacket and flung it on a chair. Spicer hated his bow tie. "How much can they pay?" "Have you guys quoted a fee?" Trevor asked. "Beach may have, I don't know. We try to get $5,000 for a 2255 reduction." Spicer said this as if he had practiced criminal law in the federal courts for years. Truth was, the only time he'd actually seen a federal courtroom was the day he was sentenced. "I know," Trevor said. "I'm not sure they can pay $5,000. The kid had a public defender for a lawyer." "Then squeeze whatever you can, but get at least $1,000 up front. He's not a bad kid.
You're getting soft, Joe Roy.
No, I'm getting meaner.
And in fact, he was. Joe Roy was the managing partner of the Brethren. Yarber and Beach had the talent and the training, but they'd been too humiliated by their fall to have any ambition. Spicer, with no training and little talent, possessed enough manipulative skills to keep his colleagues on track. While they brooded, he dreamed of his comeback.
Joe Roy opened a file and withdrew a check.
Here's $1,000 to deposit. Came from a pen pal in Texas named Curtis.
What's his potential?
Very good, I think. We're ready to bust Quince in Iowa.
Joe Roy withdrew a pretty lavender envelope, tightly sealed and addressed to Quince Garby in Bakers, Iowa.
How much? Trevor asked, taking the envelope.
$100,000.
Wow.
He's got it, and he'll pay it. I've given him the wiring instructions. Alert the bank.
In 23 years of practicing law, Trevor had never earned a fee anywhere close to $33,000. Suddenly he could see it, touch it, and though he tried not to, he began spending it. $33,000 for doing nothing but shuttling mail.
You really think this will work?
He asked, mentally paying off the tab at Pete's bar and telling MasterCard to take this check and shove it. He'd keep the same car, his beloved Beetle, but he might spring for an air conditioner.
Of course it will, Spicer said, without a trace of doubt.
He had two more letters, both written by Justice Yarber, posing as young Percy in rehab. Trevor took them with anticipation.
Arkansas is at Kentucky tonight,
Spicer said, returning to his newspaper. The line is 14, what do you think?
Much closer than that. Kentucky's very tough at home.
Are you in?
Are you?
Trevor had a bookie at Pete's bar, and though he gambled little, he had learned to follow the lead of Justice Spicer.
I'll put $100 on Arkansas, Spicer said.
I think I will, too. They played blackjack for half an hour, with Link occasionally glancing in and frowning his disapproval. Cards were prohibited during visitation, but who cared? Joe Roy played the game hard because he was training for his next career. Poker and gin rummy were the favorites in the rec room, and Spicer often had trouble finding a blackjack opponent. Trevor wasn't particularly good, but he was always willing to play. It was, in Spicer's opinion, his only redeeming quality. Chapter 5. The announcement had the festive air of a victory party, with red, white, and blue banners and bunting draped from the ceiling and parade music blasting through the hangar. Every D.L. Trilling employee was required to be present, all 4,000 of them, and to heighten their spirits they had been promised a full day of extra vacation. 8 hours paid at an average wage of $22.40, but management didn't care because they had found their man. The hastily built stage was also covered in banners and packed with every suit in the company, all smiling broadly and clapping wildly as the music whipped the crowd into a frenzy. 3 days earlier, no one had heard of Aaron Lake. Now he was their savior. He certainly looked like a candidate, with a new, slightly trimmer haircut suggested by one consultant and a dark brown suit suggested by another. Only Reagan had been able to wear brown suits, and he'd won 2 landslides. When Lake finally appeared and strode purposefully across the stage, shaking vigorously the hands of corporate honchos he'd never see again, the laborers went wild. The music was carefully ratcheted up a couple of notches by a sound consultant, who was a member of a sound team Lake's people had hired for $24,000 for the event. Money was of little concern. Balloons fell like manna. Some were popped by workers who'd been asked to pop them, so for a few seconds the hangar sounded like the first wave of a ground attack. Get ready for it. Get ready for war. Lake before it's too late. The Trilling CEO clutched him as if they were fraternity brothers, when in fact they'd met 2 hours earlier. The CEO then took the podium and waited for the noise to subside. Working with notes he'd been faxed the day before, he began a long-winded and quite generous introduction of Aaron Lake, future president. On cue, the applause interrupted him 5 times before he finished. Lake waved like a conquering hero and waited behind the microphone, then with perfect timing stepped forward and said, "My name is Aaron Lake, and I am now running for president." More roaring applause, more piped-in parade music, more balloons drifting downward. When he'd had enough, he launched into his speech. The theme, the platform, the only reason for running was national security, and Lake hammered out the appalling statistics proving just how thoroughly the current administration had depleted our military. No other issues were really that important, he said bluntly. Lure us into a war we can't win, and we'll forget about the tired old quarrels over abortion, race, guns, affirmative action, taxes. Concerned about family values? Start losing our sons and daughters in combat, and you'd see some families with real problems. Lake was very good. The speech had been written by him, edited by consultants, polished by other professionals, and the night before he delivered it to Teddy Maynard, alone, deep inside Langley. Teddy had approved with minor changes. Teddy was tucked under his quilts and watching the show with great pride. York was with him, silent as usual. The two often sat alone, staring at screens, watching the world grow more dangerous. "He's good," York said quietly at one point. Teddy nodded, even managed a slight smile. Halfway through his speech, Lake became wonderfully angry at the Chinese. "Over a 20-year period, we allowed them to steal 40% of our nuclear secrets," he said, and the laborers hissed. 40%, he shouted. It was closer to 50, but Teddy chose to downplay it just a little. The CIA had received its share of blame for the Chinese thievery. For 5 minutes, Aaron Lake blistered the Chinese and their looting and their unprecedented military buildup. The strategy was Teddy's. Use the Chinese to scare the American voters, not the Russians. Don't tip them. Protect the real threat until later in the campaign. Lake's timing was near perfect. His punchline brought down the house. When he promised to double the defense budget in the first 4 years of his administration, the 4,000 DL Trilling employees who built military helicopters exploded in a frenzy. Teddy watched it quietly, very proud of his creation. They had managed to upstage the spectacle in New Hampshire by simply snubbing it. Lake's name had not been on the ballot, and he was the first candidate in decades to be proud of that fact. "Who needs New Hampshire?" he'd been quoted as saying. "I'll take the rest of the country." Lake signed off amid thunderous applause and reshook all the hands on the stage. CNN returned to its studio where the talking heads would spend 15 minutes telling the viewers what they had just witnessed. On his table, Teddy pushed buttons and the screen changed. "Here's the finished product," he said. "The first installment." It was a television ad for candidate Lake, and it began with a brief glimpse of a row of grim Chinese generals standing rigidly at a military parade, watching massive hardware roll by. "You think the world's a safer place?" a deep, rich, ominous voice asked off camera. Then glimpses of the world's current madmen, all watching their armies parade by. Hussein, Gaddafi, Milosevic, Kim in North Korea, even poor Castro, with the last of his ragtag army lumbering through Havana, got a split second of airtime. "Our military could not now do what it did in 1991 during the Gulf War," the voice said, as gravely as if another war had already been declared. Then a blast. An atomic mushroom, followed by thousands of Indians dancing in the streets. Another blast, and the Pakistanis were dancing next door. "China wants to invade Taiwan," the voice continued, as a million Chinese soldiers marched in perfect step. "North Korea wants South Korea," the voice said, as tanks rolled through the DMZ. And the United States is always an easy target. The voice changed quickly into one with a high pitch, and the ad shifted to a congressional hearing of some sort, with a heavily bemedaled general lecturing some subcommittee. "You, the Congress," he was saying, "spend less on the military each year. This defense budget is smaller than it was 15 years ago. You expect us to be ready for war in Korea, the Middle East, and now Eastern Europe, yet our budget keeps shrinking. The situation is critical." The ad went blank, nothing but a dark screen. Then the first voice said, 12 years ago, there were 2 superpowers. Now there are none." The handsome face of Aaron Lake appeared, and the ad finished with the voice saying, "Lake, before it's too late." "I'm not sure I like it," York said after a pause. "Why not?" "It's so negative." "Good. Makes you feel uncomfortable, doesn't it?"
"Very much so."
"Good. We're going to flood television for a week, and I suspect Lake's soft numbers will get even softer. The ads will make people squirm, and they won't like them." York knew what was coming. The people would indeed squirm and dislike the ads, then get the hell scared out of them, and Lake would suddenly become a visionary. Teddy was working on the terror. There were 2 TV rooms on each wing at Trumbull, 2 small bare rooms where you could smoke and watch whatever the guards wanted you to watch. No remote, they'd tried that at first, but it had caused too much trouble. By far the nastiest disagreements occurred when the boys couldn't agree on what to watch. So the guards made the selections. Rules prohibited inmates from having their own TVs. The guard on duty happened to like basketball. There was a college game on ESPN, and the room was packed with inmates. Hatley Beach hated sports, and he sat alone in the other TV room and watched one banal sitcom after another. When he was on the bench and working 12 hours a day, he had never watched television. Who had the time? He'd had an office in his home where he dictated opinions until late while everyone else was glued to prime time. Now, watching the mindless crap, he realized how lucky he'd been, in so many ways. He lit a cigarette. He hadn't smoked since college, and for the first 2 months at Trumbull, he'd resisted the temptation. Now it helped with the boredom, but only a pack a day. His blood pressure was up and down. Heart disease ran in the family. At 56, with 9 years to go, he would leave in a box. He was certain. 3 years, 1 month, 1 week, and Beach was still counting the days in as opposed to the days to go. Just 4 years ago, he'd been building his reputation as a tough young federal judge who was going places. 4 rotten years. When he traveled from one courthouse to the next in East Texas, he did so with a driver, a secretary, a clerk, and a U.S. Marshal. When he walked into a courtroom, people stood out of respect. Lawyers gave him high marks for his fairness and hard work. His wife had been an unpleasant woman, but with her family's oil trust, he'd managed to live peacefully with her. The marriage was stable, not exactly warm, but with 3 fine kids in college, they had reason to be proud. They had weathered some rough times and were determined to grow old together. She had the money, he had the status. Together they'd raised a family. Where was there to go? Certainly not to prison. 4 miserable years. The drinking came from nowhere. Maybe it was pressure from work. Maybe it was to escape his wife's bickering. For years after law school, he'd been a light social drinker, nothing serious, certainly not a habit. Once, when the kids were small, his wife took them to Italy for 2 weeks. Beach was left alone, which suited him fine. For some reason he could never determine or remember, he turned to bourbon. Lots of it, and he never stopped. The bourbon became important. He kept it in his study and sneaked it late at night. They had separate beds, so he seldom got caught. Their trip to Yellowstone had been a 3-day judicial conference. He'd met the young lady in a bar in Jackson Hole. After hours of drinking, they made the sad decision to take a ride. While Hatley drove, she took off her clothes, but for no other reason than to just do it. Sex had not been discussed, and at that point he was completely harmless. The two hikers were from D.C., just college kids returning from the trails. Both died at the scene, slaughtered on the shoulder of a narrow road by a drunken driver who never saw them. The young lady's car was found in a ditch, with Beach hugging the steering wheel, unable to remove himself. She was naked and knocked out. He remembered nothing. When he awoke, hours later, he saw for the first time the inside of a cell. "Better get used to it," the sheriff had said with a sneer. Beach called in every favor and pulled every string imaginable, all to no avail. Two young people were dead. He'd been caught with a naked woman. His wife had the oil money, so his friends ran like scared dogs. In the end, no one stood up for the Honorable Hatley Beach. He was lucky to get 12 years. Mad mothers and sad students protested outside the courthouse when he made his first official appearance. They wanted a life sentence. Life. He himself, the Honorable Hatley Beach, was charged with 2 counts of manslaughter, and there was no defense. There was enough alcohol in his blood to kill the next guy. A witness said he'd been speeding on the wrong side of the road. Looking back, he'd been lucky his crime was on federal lands. Otherwise, he would have been shipped away to some state pen where things were much tougher. Say what you want, but the feds knew how to run a prison. He smoked alone in the semi-darkness, watching primetime comedy written by 12-year-olds, and there was a political ad, one of many those days. It was one Beach had never seen, a menacing little segment with a somber voice predicting doom if we didn't hurry and build more bombs. It was very well done, ran for 1.5 minutes, cost a bundle, and delivered a message no one wanted to hear. Lake before it's too late. Who the hell's Aaron Lake? Beach knew his politics. It had been his passion in another life, and at Trumbull he was known as a fellow who watched Washington. He was one of the few who cared what happened there. Aaron Lake? Beach had missed the guy. What an odd strategy to enter the race as an unknown after New Hampshire. Never a shortage of clowns who want to be president. Beach's wife kicked him out before he pled guilty to 2 counts of manslaughter. Quite naturally, she was angrier over the naked woman than the dead hikers. The kid sided with her because she had the money and because he'd screwed up so badly. It was an easy decision on their part. The divorce was final 1 week after he arrived at Trumbull. His youngest had been to see him 2 times in 3 years, 1 month, and 1 week. Both visits were on the sly, lest the mother find out about them. She had prohibited the kids from going to Trumbull. Then he got sued, 2 wrongful death cases brought by the families. With no friends willing to step forward, he tried to defend himself from prison. But there wasn't much to defend. A judgment of $5 million had been entered against him by the trial court. He appealed from Trumbull, lost from Trumbull, and appealed again. In the chair beside him, next to his cigarettes, was an envelope brought earlier by Trevor, the lawyer. The court had rejected his final appeal. The judgment was now written in stone. Didn't really matter because he'd also filed for bankruptcy. He had typed the papers himself in the law library and filed them with a pauper's oath, sent them to the same courthouse in Texas where he was once a god. Convicted, divorced, disbarred, imprisoned, sued, bankrupt. Most of the losers at Trumbull handled their time because their falls had been so short. Most were repeat offenders who'd blown 3rd and 4th chances. Most liked the damn place because it was better than any other prison they'd visited. But Beach had lost so much, had fallen so far. Just 4 years ago, he'd had a wife with millions and three kids who loved him and a big home in a small town. He was a federal judge, appointed by the president for life, making $140,000 a year, which was a lot less than her oil royalties, but still not a bad salary. He got himself called to Washington twice a year for meetings at Justice. Beach had been important. An old lawyer friend had been to see him twice on his way to Miami, where he had kids, and he stayed long enough to deliver the gossip. Most of it was worthless, but there was a strong rumor that the ex-Mrs. Beach was now seeing someone else. With a few million bucks and slender hips, it was only a matter of time. Another ad. Lake before it's too late again. This one began with a grainy video of men with guns slithering through the desert, dodging and shooting and undergoing some type of training. Then the sinister face of a terrorist, dark eyes and hair and features, obviously some manner of Islamic radical, and he said in Arabic with English subtitles, "We will kill Americans wherever we find them. We will die in our holy war against the great Satan." After that, quick videos of burning buildings, embassy bombings, a busload of tourists, the remains of a jetliner scattered through a pasture. A handsome face appeared, Mr. Aaron Lake himself. He looked directly at Hatley Beach and said, "I'm Aaron Lake, and you probably don't know me. I'm running for president because I'm scared. Scared of China and Eastern Europe and the Middle East. Scared of a dangerous world. Scared of what's happened to our military. Last year, the federal government had a surplus of $1 trillion, yet spent less on defense than we did 15 years ago. We're complacent because our economy is strong, but the world today is far more dangerous than we realize. Our enemies are legion, and we cannot protect ourselves. If elected, I will double defense spending during my term of office." No smiles, no warmth, just plain talk from a man who meant what he said. A voiceover said, "Lake, before it's too late." Not bad, thought Beach. He lit another cigarette, his last of the night, and stared at the papers in the empty chair. $5 million lodged against him by the two families. He'd pay the money if he could. Never saw the kids. Not before he killed them. The paper the next day had their happy photos, a boy and a girl. Just college kids, enjoying the summer. He missed the bourbon. He could bankrupt half the judgment. The other half was for punitive damages, non-bankruptible. So it would follow wherever he went, which he assumed was nowhere. He'd be 65 when his sentence was over, but he'd be dead before then. They'd carry him out of Trumbull in a box, send him home to Texas, where they'd bury him behind the little country church where he'd been baptized. Maybe one of the kids would spring for a headstone. Beach left the room without turning off the TV. It was almost 10, time for lights out. He bunked with Robbie, a kid from Kentucky who'd broken into 240 houses before they caught him. He sold the guns and microwaves and stereos for cocaine. Robbie was a 4-year veteran of Trumbull, and because of his seniority, he had chosen the bottom bunk. Beach crawled into the top one, said, "Good night, Robbie," and turned off the light. "Night, Hatley," came the soft response. Sometimes they chatted in the dark. The walls were cinder block, the door was metal, their words were confined to their little room. Robbie was 25 and would be 45 before he left Trumbull. 24 years. One for every 10 houses. The time between bed and sleep was the worst of the day. The past came back with a vengeance. The mistakes, the misery, the could-haves and should-haves. Try as he might, Hatley could not simply close his eyes and go to sleep. He had to punish himself first. There was a grandchild he'd never seen, and he always started with her. Then his three kids. Forget the wife. But he always thought about her money. And the friends. Ah, the friends. Where were they now?
3 years in, and with no future, there was only the past. Even poor Robbie below dreamed of a new beginning at the age of 45, not Beach. At times, he almost longed for the warm Texas soil, layered upon his body behind the little church. Surely someone would buy him a headstone. Chapter 6. For Quince Garby, February 3rd would be the worst day of his life. It was almost the last, and it would have been had his doctor been in town. He couldn't get a prescription for sleeping pills, and he didn't have the courage to use a gun on himself. It began pleasantly enough, with a late breakfast, a bowl of oatmeal by the fire in the den alone. His wife of 26 years had already left for town for another day of charity teas and fundraising and frantic small-town volunteerism that kept her busy and away from him. It was snowing when he left their large and pretentious banker's home on the edge of Bakers, Iowa, and drove 10 minutes to work in his long black Mercedes, 11 years old. He was an important man about town, a Garby, a member of a family that had owned the bank for generations. He parked in his reserved spot behind the bank, which faced Main Street, and made a quick detour to the post office, something he did twice a week. For years, he'd had a private box there, away from his wife and especially away from his secretary. Because he was rich, and few others were in Bakers, Iowa, he seldom spoke to people on the street. He didn't care what they thought. They worshipped his father, and that was enough to keep their business. But when the old man died, would he have to change his personality? Would he be forced to smile on the sidewalks of Bakers and join the Rotary Club, the one founded by his grandfather? Quince was tired of being dependent on the whims of the public for his security. He was tired of relying on his father to keep their customers happy. He was tired of banking and tired of Iowa and tired of snow and tired of his wife, and what Quince wanted more than anything that morning in February was a letter from his beloved Ricky. A nice, brief little note confirming their rendezvous. What Quince really wanted was 3 warm days on a love boat with Ricky. He might never come back. Bakers had 18,000 people, so the central post office on Main was usually busy. And there was always a different clerk behind the counter. That's how he'd rented the box. He'd waited until a new postal worker was on duty. CMT Investments was the official lessee. He went straight to the box, around a corner to a wall with 100 others. There were 3 letters, and as he snatched them and stuffed them in his coat pocket, his heart froze as he saw that one was from Ricky. He hurried on to Maine, and minutes later entered his bank at exactly 10 a.m. His father had been there for 4 hours, but they had long since stopped bickering over Quince's work schedule. As always, he stopped at his secretary's desk to hurriedly remove his gloves, as if important matters were waiting. She handed him his mail, his 2 phone messages, and reminded him that he had lunch in 2 hours with a local realtor. He locked his door behind him, flung his gloves one way and his coat the other, and ripped open the letter from Ricky. He sat on his sofa and put on his reading glasses, breathing heavily not from the walk but from anticipation. He was on the verge of arousal when he started reading. The words hit like bullets. After the second paragraph, he emitted a strange, painful, "Ah!" Then a couple of, "Oh, my gods!" Then a low, hissing, "Son of a bitch!" "Quiet," he told himself. "The secretary is always listening." The first reading brought shock. The second, disbelief. Reality began settling in with the third reading, and Quince's lips started to quiver. "Don't cry, damn it," he told himself. He threw the letter on the floor and paced around his desk, ignoring as best he could the cheerful faces of his wife and children. 20 years' worth of class photos and family portraits were lined along his credenza, just under the window. He looked out and watched the snow, now heavier and accumulating on the sidewalks. God, how he hated Bakers, Iowa.
He thought he might leave and escape to the beach, where he could frolic with a handsome young pal and maybe never come home. Now he would leave under different circumstances. It was a joke, a hoax, he told himself. But he instantly knew better. The scam was too tight. The punchline was too perfect. He'd been set up by a professional. All his life he'd fought his desires. Somehow he'd finally found the nerve to crack the closet door, and now he got shot between the eyes by a con man. Stupid, stupid, stupid. How could this be so difficult? Random thoughts hit from every direction as he watched the snow. Suicide was the easy answer, but his doctor was gone and he really didn't want to die. At least not at the moment. He wasn't sure where he'd find $100,000 he could send off without raising suspicions. The old bastard next door paid him a pittance and kept his thumb on every dime. His wife insisted on balancing their checkbook. There was some money in mutuals, but he couldn't move it without her knowing. The life of a rich banker in Bakers, Iowa, meant a title and a Mercedes and a large mortgaged house and a wife with social activities. Oh, how he wanted to escape. He'd go to Florida anyway and track the letter somehow and confront this con man, expose his extortion attempt, find some justice. He, Quince Garby, had done nothing wrong. Surely a crime was being perpetrated here. Perhaps he could hire an investigator and maybe a lawyer and they'd protect him. They'd get to the bottom of this scam. Even if he found the money and wired it as instructed, the gate would be opened, and Ricky, whoever in hell Ricky was, might want more. What would stop Ricky from extorting again and again? If he had guts, he'd run off anyway, run to Key West or some hot spot where it never snowed, and live any damn way he wanted to live, and let the pitiful little people of Bakers, Iowa, gossip about him for the next half century. But he didn't have the guts. And that's what made Quince so sad. His children were staring at him, freckled smiles with teeth wrapped in silver braces. His heart sank, and he knew he'd find the money and wire it precisely as directed. He had to protect them. They had done nothing wrong. The bank's stock was worth about $10 million. All of it still tightly controlled by the old man, who at the moment was barking in the hallway. The old man was 81, very much alive, but still 81. When he was gone, Quince would have to contend with a sister in Chicago, but the bank would be his. He'd sell the damn thing as fast as he could and leave Bakers with a few million in his pocket. Until then, though, he'd be forced to do what he'd always done, keep the old man content. Getting yanked out of the closet by some con man would devastate his father and pretty much take care of the stock. Sister in Chicago would get all of it. When the barking stopped outside, he eased through the door and passed his secretary for a cup of coffee. He ignored her as he returned to his room, locked his door, read the letter for the fourth time, and began to make plans. He'd find the money. And he'd wire it just as instructed, and he'd hope and pray with a fury that Ricky would go away. If not, if he came back for more, Quince would call his doctor and get some pills. The realtor he was meeting for lunch was a high roller who took chances and cut corners, probably a crook. Quince began to make plans. The two of them would arrange a few shady loans, overappraise some land, lend the money, sell to a straw man, etc. The realtor would know how to do it. Quince would find the money. The Lake Campaign's doomsday ads landed with a thud, at least in public opinion. Massive polling through the first week showed a dramatic increase in name recognition, from 2% to 20%, but the ads were universally disliked. They were frightening, and people just didn't want to think about wars and terrorism and old nukes getting hauled across mountains in the dark. People saw the ads, they were impossible to miss, and they heard the message, but most voters simply didn't want to be bothered. They were too busy making money and spending it. When issues were confronted in the midst of a roaring economy, they were limited to the old standbys of family values and tax cuts. Candidate Lake's early interviewers treated him as just another flake, until he announced, live on the air, that his campaign had received in excess of $11 million in less than a week. "We expect to have $20 million in 2 weeks," he said without boasting, and real news started to happen. Teddy Maynard had assured him the money would be there. $20 million in 2 weeks had never been done before, and by the end of that day, Washington was consumed with the story. The frenzy reached its peak when Lake was interviewed live, yet again, by two of the three networks on the evening news. He looked great. Big smile, smooth words, nice suit and hair. The man was electable. Final confirmation that Aaron Lake was a serious candidate came late in the day, when one of his opponents took a shot at him. Senator Britt of Maryland had been running for a year and had finished a strong second in New Hampshire. He'd raised $9 million, spent a lot more than that, and was forced to waste half of his time soliciting money rather than campaigning. He was tired of begging, tired of cutting staff, tired of worrying about TV ads, and when a reporter asked him about Lake and his $20 million, Britt shot back, "It's dirty money. No honest candidate can raise that much that fast." Britt was shaking hands in the rain at the entrance to a chemical plant in Michigan. The dirty money comment was seized with great gusto by the press and soon splattered all over the place. Aaron Lake had arrived. Senator Britt of Maryland had other problems, though he'd tried to forget them. 9 years earlier, he'd toured Southeast Asia to find some facts. As always, he and his colleagues from the Congress flew first class, stayed in nice hotels, and ate lobster, all in an effort to study poverty in the region and get to the bottom of the raging controversy brought about by Nike and its use of cheap foreign labor. Early in the journey, Britt met a girl in Bangkok, and feigning illness, decided to stay behind while his buddies continued their fact-finding into Laos and Vietnam. Her name was Peka, and she was not a prostitute. She was a 20-year-old secretary in the U.S. Embassy in Bangkok, and because she was on his country's payroll, Britt felt a slight proprietary interest. He was far away from Maryland, from his wife and five kids and his constituents. Peka was stunning and shapely and anxious to study in the United States. What began as a fling quickly turned into a romance, and Senator Britt had to force himself to return to Washington. 2 months later, he was back in Bangkok on, as he told his wife, pressing but secret business. In 9 months, he made 4 trips to Thailand, all first class, all at taxpayer expense, and even the Globetrotters in the Senate were beginning to whisper. Britt pulled strings with the State Department, and Peka appeared to be headed for the United States. She never made it. During the fourth and final rendezvous, Peka confessed that she was pregnant. She was Catholic, and abortion was not an option. Britt stiff-armed her, said he needed time to think, then fled Bangkok in the middle of the night. The fact-finding was over. Early in his Senate career, Britt, a fiscal hardliner, had grabbed a headline or two by criticizing CIA wastefulness. Teddy Maynard said not a word, but certainly didn't appreciate the grandstanding. The rather thin file on Senator Britt was dusted off and given priority, and when he went to Bangkok for the second time, the CIA went with him. Of course, he didn't know it, but they sat near him on the flight, first class also, and they had people on the ground in Bangkok. They watched the hotel where the two lovebirds spent 3 days. They took pictures of them eating in fine restaurants. They saw everything. Britt was oblivious and stupid. A year later, when the child was born, the CIA obtained the hospital records, then the medical records to link the blood and DNA. Peka kept her job at the embassy, so she was easy to find. When the child was a year old, he was photographed sitting on Peka's knee in a downtown park. More photos followed, and by the time he was 4, he was beginning to remotely favor Senator Dan Britt of Maryland. His daddy was long gone. Britt's zeal for finding facts in Southeast Asia had faded dramatically, and he'd turned his attention to other critical areas of the world. In due course, he was seized with presidential ambitions, the old senatorial affliction that sooner or later gets them all. He'd never heard from Peka, and that nightmare had been easy to forget. Britt had 5 legitimate children and a wife with a big mouth. They were a team, Senator and Mrs. Britt, both leading the juggernaut of family values and we've gotta save our kids. Together they wrote a book on how to raise children in a sick American culture, though their oldest was only 13. When the president was embarrassed by sexual misadventures, Senator Britt became the biggest virgin in Washington. He and his wife struck a nerve, and the money rolled in from conservatives. He did well in the Iowa caucuses, ran a close second in New Hampshire, but was running out of money and sinking in the polls. He would sink even more. After a brutal day of campaigning, his entourage settled into a motel in Dearborn, Michigan, for a short night. It was there that the senator finally came face to face with child number 6, though not in person. The agent's name was McCord, and he'd been following Britt with phony press credentials for a week. He said he worked for a newspaper in Tallahassee, but in fact he'd been a CIA agent for 11 years. There were so many reporters swarming around Britt that no one thought to check. McCord befriended a senior aide, and over a late drink in the Holiday Inn bar, he confessed that he had something in his possession that would destroy candidate Britt. He said it was given to him by a rival camp, Governor Terry's. It was a notebook with a bomb on every page, an affidavit from Peka setting forth the broad details of their affair. 2 photos of the child, the last of which had been taken a month earlier, and the child, now 7, looking more and more like his dad. Blood and DNA summaries indelibly linking father and son, and travel records which showed in black and white that Senator Britt had burned $38,600 in taxpayers' money to carry on his affair on the other side of the world. The deal was simple and straightforward. Withdraw from the race immediately, and the story would never be told. McCord, the journalist, was ethical and didn't have the stomach for such trash. Governor Terry would keep it quiet if Britt disappeared. Quit, and not even Mrs. Britt would know. Shortly after 1 a.m. in Washington, Teddy Maynard took the call from McCord. The package had been delivered. Britt was planning a press conference for noon the next day. Teddy had dirt files on hundreds of politicians, past and present. As a group, they were an easy bunch to trap. Place a beautiful young woman in their path and you generally gathered something for the file. If women didn't work, money always did. Watch them travel, watch them crawl in bed with the lobbyists, watch them pander to any foreign government smart enough to send lots of cash to Washington, watch them set up their campaigns and committees to raise funds. Just watch them. And the files always grew thicker. He wished the Russians were so easy. Though he despised politicians as a group, he did respect a handful of them. Aaron Lake was one. He'd never chased women, never drank much or picked up habits, never seemed preoccupied with cash, never had been inclined to grandstand. The more he watched Lake, the more he liked him. He took his last pill of the night and rolled himself to bed. So Britt was gone. Good riddance. Too bad he couldn't leak the story anyway. The pious hypocrite deserved a good thrashing. Save it, he told himself, and use it again. President Lake might need Britt one day, and that little boy over in Thailand might come in handy. Chapter 7. Picasso was suing Sherlock and other unnamed defendants for injunctive relief in an effort to stop them from urinating on his roses. A little misdirected urine was not going to upset the balance of life at Trumbull, but Picasso also wanted damages in the amount of $500. $500 was a serious matter. The dispute had been festering since the past summer when Picasso caught Sherlock in the act, and the assistant warden had finally intervened.
This book is continued on Disc 3.